funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it that makes junk food so addictive? Plenty of us like apples and salad and broiled fish, but we can easily stop once we've had our fill of them, which is a lot tougher to do with a bag of chips, a carton of ice cream, or a cold glass of sugary soda. And as my guest today will tell us, it's no accident that we feel powerless to resist the vast array of heavily processed foods available to us around the clock and on every corner. Many modern convenience foods are a sort of masterpiece of chemistry, psychology, and marketing. But while they're cheap to manufacture and to buy, many Americans are paying a high price in eating these foods in terms of their health. Michael Moss is a reporter for The New York Times and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So I asked in my introduction what makes processed food so addictive, but maybe it's more accurate to ask who makes it so addictive.
It's the scientists, the mathematicians, the marketing officials at the largest food companies who are extraordinary in their ability to formulate and package and position foods that will make us go over the moon. I mean, for me, the reporting and researching for this book was almost like being inside a detective story, getting insiders at these companies to reveal their secrets. And I had a treasure trove of internal documents that opened their world for me. And ultimately, it comes down to those three ingredients, salt, sugar, fat. Those are the pillars of the processed food industry, their holy grail, if you will, on which they survive.
You mentioned mathematicians. That was not just hyperbolic speech. The folks at Frito-Lay have actually devised a formula to apply to their products to ensure that they're irresistible.
You know, one of the top scientists there in the 80s, who in fact during his years was pushing back, or rather pushing the company to reduce its usage of salt very early on in the growing public concern about salt, at one point sort of came up with this intriguing formula for capturing the ideal snack. And it weighed things like convenience and low cost on one hand, and then public health concern on the other. And being a brilliant scientist, he put this into, like, you know, one of those complex equations you see up on a whiteboard in universities. Totally fascinating.
And product developers are always looking to identify the exact bliss point of a product. What is that?
I spent time with a legend in the food industry named Howard Moskowitz, and he walked me through what he did recently to create a new soda for Dr. Pepper. It was a cherry vanilla flavor, but to get there, he came up with, or had to come up with, dozens of different formulas of sweetness and flavorings, each one slightly different than the other. And he had thousands of panelists in cities across the country taste these with the idea of then gathering that data, throwing it into a computer, analyzing it through regression analysis, and then coming up with the very perfect amount of sweet flavor that would appeal to most people. And the interesting thing about sugar is that we can get too much.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bell curve, and you and your listeners can do this experiment. Just take a cup of coffee, add sugar until it's at the point where you like it the most, and keep adding sugar, and you'll find that your taste preference, you know, drops off. And that's true for sugary foods all over the place. And so Howard Moskowitz helped coin this term, the bliss point, for that perfect place at the top of the bell curve where just enough sugar and not too much, it will send products flying off the shelves.
And of course, salt works the same way, but not fat.
Yeah, fat is really interesting. In some ways, fat is even more powerful than sugar. I mean, they both go from your taste buds to the pleasure center of your brain and send signals to eat. But fat is described by food scientists as being invisible in many ways. There are different types of fats and oils. The one to be concerned about nutritionally is saturated fat. That's the one that's linked to heart disease. It's also the fat that's solid. And when presented as a solid thing, the brain doesn't recognize it as fat. fat has twice the calories of sugar. But when you eat things like cheese, and especially cheese that's been added as an ingredient to food, you trick your brain into underestimating the amount of fat and calories that it's getting. So it's hugely effective for companies that are trying to increase the allure of their product. And boy, is it alluring. I mean, cheese has, they describe cheese as having a mouth feel. There are nerve endings in the roof of your mouth that go right to your brain. And it's the warm, gooey sensation of biting into a melted. I mean, I'm dreaming. I'm talking about it right now. I see images of my brain is going, Michael, go get a cheese sandwich, melted cheese sandwich. I mean, it has that kind of effect on people, you know, almost even more than sugar.
And we love cheese in particular so much that I have to tell you, this number astonished me. We're eating 33 pounds of it per person per year.
On an average, and, you know, that just, you know, people couldn't figure out how did that happen. That's three times the amount of cheese that we ate back in the 1970s. And that became sort of part of my detective story as well. And the story is fascinating. It basically goes like this. Back in the 60s, people stopped drinking as much whole milk in order to, say, reduce calories and eliminate saturated fat from their diets. That left the dairy industry with a glut of whole milk and the thing called milk fat, which they extract out of whole milk in order to make skim milk. The dairy industry started turning that milk and the milk fat into cheese. And for a while, the federal government would buy all of this extra cheese. They were making so much, people couldn't eat it. And the federal government stepped in and started buying this extra cheese. It got stored, believe it or not, in caves in Missouri until the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan came into office, started cutting the federal budget, discovered the $4 billion that had been spent buying surplus cheese that was going moldy, and his Secretary of Agriculture said, no more, we're not going to buy this surplus cheese anymore. But because the federal government for years has subsidized the dairy industry and doesn't want dairy farmers to go out of business, it came up with something else. And the something else was to design a marketing program that would solve the problem of people not eating cheese by encouraging them to eat more cheese. And so tens of millions of dollars started to be spent on advertising for cheese, but more importantly, the processed food manufacturers began using cheese as an additive to products. And so that's when you started to go to fast food chains and there would be cheese on every sandwich. And it's almost in products in almost every aisle of the grocery store now as an added bit of allure that makes their products even all the more exciting and craveable.
You know, I actually remember PSAs that ran when I was a kid, and it was all about, like, having a snack and how important that was, and that cheese was a really good choice, which seems like something we wouldn't. It's like telling your kids to eat some sugar cubes, you know.
I met one of the early marketing people who worked at it, and she said, you know, initially she had to convince the sandwich chains to offer cheese on their sandwiches. It didn't make sense to them, and she did some experiments looking at their sales data, and sure enough, when they offered cheese, not only did sales went up, but people loved it more, and they made more money by the added on cheese because they could charge more. You know, dial forward today, and this is why you have pizza chains adding two, three, four types of cheese on top of the pizza, and then putting two more cheeses inside the crust.
So another trick that food companies will use is to add extra sugar or salt or fat into foods that we instinctively assume are healthy. Talk about Yoplait yogurt.
Yeah, Yoplait was an acquisition, actually, of General Foods. And, you know, way back in the day, yogurt was generally unsweetened or not so sweetened, and gradually food companies, you know, began adding more sugar to yogurt. And people didn't really notice because yogurt has this amazing halo of health. And today you can find some versions, well, Yoplait is one of the many versions of yogurt that has upwards of 3/4 the amount of sugar as ice cream. And so nutritionists will tell you, fine, you know, eat yogurt, but eat it as a dessert, not as a health food, as people might imply. And you mentioned low fat, too. One of the dangers and one of the misleading things in the grocery store is when a product, you know, touts itself as being low fat or low sugar. Quite often, when you turn to the fine print, you're going to find that the manufacturer maintained or increased the other two of those ingredients in order to maintain the taste. Because that's the bottom line for these companies. These are companies, and they're in the business to sell products, make money, and making every one of their products as palatable, craveable as possible is what they do. And you can't hold that against them, but it's really important to understand that when you're looking at the public health crisis of obesity.
So there was a point when Philip Morris, which is the parent company of Kraft, said, look, we need to make some changes here in terms of the content of some of our products, and the obesity crisis is looming. Was Philip Morris concerned about the health of all of its customers, or was it concerned that the government might step in the same way that they have regulated tobacco?
Philip Morris was concerned about public trust, and I have to go back a little bit. Philip Morris acquired General Foods and then Kraft in the 1980s and became the largest food manufacturer in the country. And it did what you would expect from a tobacco company or any company for that matter. It encouraged in as many ways as it could its food division to make more attractive food, market it better, and make more money. And that went on through much of the 90s. Gradually, though, and increasingly, Philip Morris and the rest of the tobacco companies came under huge pressure from regulators and the public on tobacco and nicotine. And Philip Morris became so concerned that it was on the verge of losing public confidence, consumer confidence, their trust, that it became the first company to embrace government regulation of tobacco. It broke with the other tobacco companies. And when it did that, its executives, you know, stood up and looked around the Philip Morris company, saw the food division and said, hey, wait a minute, if we're reconsidering our marketing and use of nicotine, what are they doing? And they identified none other than salt, sugar, fat, and the looming obesity crisis as being potential problems for the food division as great, if not greater in magnitude, than nicotine was for tobacco. And they began nudging the food managers to reconsider their huge dependence on those three ingredients.
So did foods change a lot because of this? You say nudge.
Another fascinating story, because at the same time, within Kraft, which is now the largest food company in the country, having blended with General Foods, a cobble of insiders separately on their own was becoming concerned about the obesity crisis. They began agitating within Kraft itself, now helped by Philip Morris, and convinced the top officials at Kraft that they needed to reconsider all of their practices from the standpoint of obesity and ask the question, are we doing anything, even subconsciously, subliminally, that would encourage our consumers to overeat? And Kraft put together a panel of outside experts who advised it on things to do, and they did some really amazing things. They looked at their marketing to kids.
You know, let me jump in, Michael. We need to take a break, and I want to make sure we get all of this. Michael Moss is with us. He's a reporter for The New York Times, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Michael Moss. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. So, Michael, what changed at Kraft?
Kraft did three really amazing things. It looked at the way it was marketing its products for kids, and it decided that it was way too aggressive in marketing the more sugary products to kids, and it cut back on its advertising, its pitches, and scaled back even on the sugar content on those foods. The second thing it did, it looked at the packaging, and it realized that it had some products that had multiple servings in them, and yet on the back of the package, it would provide nutrient information just based on a single serving. So, for example, a package of cookies might have two or three servings. It knew from its own research that you and I were likely to sit down and eat the whole bag, mm-hmm. and yet it only provided numbers on calories and fat and sugar for one little serving. So you had to do the math themselves, and they felt that was deceptive, and they set out actually to do the math for consumers. And so customers of Kraft could now see on the package the total number of calories and the total number of saturated fat grams and sugar, so you'd have a better sense of what you're consuming. And then thirdly, here's the huge thing that they did. They put caps on the amount of salt, sugar, fat that their food inventors, their engineers could use in making their products attractive, which was a huge thing because up until that point, as one of their top officials told me, every ounce of everyone's energy at the company was put into making their products every bit as attractive, alluring as possible, craveable as possible, if you will. Now they were saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're going to limit that. And that was really psychologically for the company huge and a turning point.
I want to go back to, you mentioned earlier developing the bliss point for a new flavor of Dr. Pepper. I want to talk about the soda industry. First of all, when you talk about the amount of calories in soda, we all know the sugary ones have just a ton of calories. Mm-hmm. And our bodies don't take in those calories and then think, oh, I'm not so hungry for lunch today, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, there's a couple things going on with liquids. I spent a lot of time with some scientists in Philadelphia at a place called the Monell Center, mm-hmm. which is partly funded by the food industry, which in my eyes gives them more credibility because their scientists are hugely concerned about the way the processed food industry shapes our dietary habits. And liquids are of concern for them. The latest science seems to be indicating that our brains are less apt to detect calories in liquids. So when you're getting the full sugar calorie sodas, your brain is not telling you, hey, I'm full, I'm satisfied, as strongly as it will if you're eating a batch of cookies. That's sort of one thing. And the other thing that obesity experts are finding is that when people gravitate toward diet sodas, and the soda companies love diet sodas because it's a line extension. It doesn't detract from their sales of regular sodas. But obesity experts are warning that when people glom on to diet sodas as a way of controlling their weight, they have to be really, really careful because it won't work if you then go out and eat a big muffin or a handful of cookies. You have to apply that strict diligence to your entire day-long, night-long eating pattern, and then maybe it'll work. So there's a real cautionary note out there, even with diet sodas.
And for the soda companies, boy, the best customer is drinking, what, upwards of 3 cans a day?
I wasn't even going to write about Coca-Cola for this book because I thought we knew everything about them. And then I met Geoffrey Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
And Geoffrey Dunn was Coca-Cola's ultimate warrior for 20 years. He rose in the ranks to become president of North America and Latin America and then had a change of heart I can talk to you about. But during his time at Coke, he described to me the phenomena of the heavy user. That's what Coke called its best customer. And that was a person who drank as many as 3 cans of Coke a day. Those people make up only 20% of the Coke drinkers, but they drink 80% of the Coke. And it makes economic sense for soda and other companies, too, to concentrate their marketing efforts to target those heavy users. It's more cost effective.
And in terms of young people drinking soda, one of the concerns is that we are grooming kids to always expect a sweet taste when they consume liquid.
Another thing the folks told me at Monell, which is, you know, they're concerned not so much about the food industry ratcheting up our craving for sugar, but rather teaching kids that everything in the grocery store should taste sweet. And I was meeting with one of their scientists, and she started ticking off all these food products that not so long ago weren't sweet. Bread, tomato sauce. Oh, my gosh, you go in the pasta sauce aisle, and you can find tomato sauces with the equivalent of as much sugar in them as a couple more, even, Oreo cookies in a little half-cup serving. Didn't used to be that way, and that's the concern of these scientists, which is that the processed food industry is teaching our kids to expect sugary foods in everything, not just in their dessert.
Before we move on to other things, I want to make sure that we get back to Jeffrey Dunn, because his sort of conversion story is strikes me as sort of a beautiful thing.
Oh, I'm glad you asked about that, Chris. So Jeffrey is plodding along. He's the heir apparent to the entire company, or one of several people, when a book arrives in his office, and it is about sugar, written by a few people, including a couple of physicians from New Orleans, who really raise the alarm about sugar and the public health. And Jeffrey reads that and he says, ah, this makes sense and this isn't good. Second thing happens, his girlfriend, fiancée at the time, is starting to badger him a little bit about his work at Coke, because he is so good. I mean, he's one of their best marketing people there. And thirdly, he goes on one of his routine rounds around North America and South America, and ends up in Brazil with his managers, and they take him into neighborhoods in Brazil where there are emerging middle-class people, and Coke, like other companies, was starting to market smaller bottles of Coke to these people in order to encourage them to eat commercial products. And Jeffrey Dunn had this epiphany. There was this moment, he says he almost could hear a voice saying to him, these kids need a lot of things, but they don't need another Coke. He went back to Coke. He tried pushing the company in the direction of more healthful nutrition things like water and cutting back on marketing of Coke to schools. Ultimately, he left the company in some frustration, and these days, he's doing the most amazing thing. He calls it his karmic debt, but he's marketing none other than fresh baby carrots using, and this is where it gets great, using the playbook from the processed food industry. He's come up with this slogan of marketing carrots as if they were junk food. And it's so telling, because think about it. When did you ever last see a jazzy cartoon advertisement for a vegetable, making it look attractive to kids? You don't, because the company spent all this money and energy marketing the highly processed foods. And I think Jeffrey really put his finger on something important here if we're going to get out of this situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org to speak with Michael Moss about his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. We have an email here from Lynn in Grapevine who says, I eat out frequently and wonder just how or why restaurants pack so many calories and sodium into their meals. Even dishes that may sound healthy and could be are packed with an incredible number of calories, fat, and sodium.
Boy, they really do. And, you know, chain restaurants are, I think, more to blame than anybody. And in part, it's for the same reason that, you know, salt, sugar, and fat are really convenient ways for chefs as well as food processing companies to maximize the allure of their foods at the least cost. I certainly know that higher-end restaurant chefs are becoming much more cognizant of this, and they can charge more for this food, so they can use real ingredients and don't have to rely on salt, sugar, fat so much. But one thing I noticed, too, is that the fast food industry and fast foods have moved into the grocery stores. And increasingly in recent years, you know, you can find foods that you never could, that are ultra-convenient, ultra-low-cost, and ultra-loaded with salt, sugar, fat.
Hmm. How many kinds of salt are there?
One company I interviewed and spent some time with counted as many as 40, including some of the additives that are added for salt for various reasons. I used to think of salt as like a rock that came out of the ground and you chopped it up and you put it on food. No way. It is designed, engineered in all kinds of ways to be compatible with whatever food you're manufacturing, whether it's pretzels or soup or what have you. So it comes powdered in many different forms of powder, granulated. My favorite, Chris, is something called kosher salt, which I use in my own home.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like snow, but it's shaped like pyramids with flat sides that enables it to stick better to food. But here's the beauty of it. It's hollowed out inside, and so your saliva has more contact with the salt, which means it sends signals to the brain of eat more faster, three times as fast it dissolves, faster than regular salt. It's the true, one of the true miracle ingredients.
Is that why you need less kosher salt, ounce for ounce or teaspoon for teaspoon, than you do of table salt?
Yeah, you know, you have to be a little careful because you can't use recipes. You can't substitute kosher salt for regular salt in recipes. You'll need more of it. Mm-hmm. What's larger?
Yeah.
So when you're looking at weight, you have to be careful with that. But this wasn't sort of the company making kosher salt wasn't looking to really sell more salt. It was just looking to deliver what they call the flavor burst that would help the processed food companies make their foods more palatable.
Sandra on the line in North Dallas. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to ask your guest about, he said he had a treasure trove information from this scientist he recruited to help him, give him this information. Was this like in writing? Was this an email shared?
That's a really great question. So here's what happened. Starting in the 80s, 90s, state's attorneys general sued the tobacco companies. And as part of a settlement, the tobacco companies were forced to release millions of pages of their internal documents. And those are now still being accumulated by a public archive in San Francisco. And as fortune would have it for me, in those documents, and these are memos, strategy papers, presentations, meeting notes, in those documents that are largely tobacco-focused are records from the Philip Morris Food Division's Kraft and General Foods. So I think I was one of the first people who started plumbing that treasure trove, and I think they're up to 81 million pages now of documentation looking for food records, and it was so revealing because, again, here are the memos, here are the strategy papers, here are the formulations being discussed between the food managers and the tobacco people at Philip Morris. And I was able to use those documents, A, to learn what was going on inside the companies, but B, to get the insiders at the food companies then to talk to me even in more depth about their work.
So we talked a little, Michael, about marketing to children and how companies have sort of waxed and waned over the years. There is also the issue of specific products designed for, say, certain ethnic communities that may be even worse health-wise than the ones that are marketed to the general population.
You know, in a very general sense, Hispanics tend to like, you know, a significant amount more salt and or sugar and or flavor profiles, as we know, maybe hot peppers. And so food companies, when they're doing their targeting, will target their formulations not only based on people's ages, For example, children have a sweet tooth than adults will, but also by race as well. And the growing Hispanic population in this country is a huge potential market, a huge market already for processed food companies. And they will train their formulation efforts to make products that are appealing to those people. I mean, on one level, it makes perfect sense.
Can you talk about products that are made for kids at lunch? And specifically, you have just an amazing analysis of the development of this thing that people with kids will recognize whether they buy them or not, Lunchables.
Lunchables was created by Oscar Mayer back in the 80s when Oscar Mayer had a bit of a problem with its meat. Meat consumption was falling off in this country because of concern about saturated fat and salt. And some of the brightest people at Oscar Mayer were tasked with coming up with a new way of selling, packaging, presenting their meat. The person in charge was a wonderful person named Bob Drain, who put together a team. He was all about saving jobs. They wanted to keep the production lines going. And he and his team came up with this idea called the Lunchables, which basically looks like a TV dinner tray in smaller form. And after much labor and scrutiny and trial and error, they came up with the small pieces of meat and the cheese and the crackers. He initially had a little napkin in the Lunchables and started selling it. And besides the ingredients, the really, truly stunning thing about Lunchables is how much psychological marketing went into it.
We'll talk about that right after this break. My guest is Michael Moss. He's a reporter for the New York Times and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Michael Moss. He works for the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Before the break, Michael, you were going to talk about the psychology that went into Lunchables. And I love this quote. Researchers found a gold mine of disappointments and problems that turned into this product.
Well, those are actually Bob Drain's words. After he sat down with mothers and listened to them talk about their day, their morning, really, and they described a 7 a.m. nightmarish crush when they and the kids and their husbands were all trying to get out the door at once, and maybe there was something in the refrigerator, maybe not, for lunches. And there, you know, Bob saw this huge opportunity for this already pre-made, cold, ready-to-eat, beautifully packaged thing called the Lunchables. And mothers, especially working moms, became sort of the first marketing target for those Lunchables. But the next target became the kids themselves. And Kraft realized that something really important about kids, which is that the Lunchables to them really wasn't about food. It was about empowerment. And they came up with this slogan of, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. And that resonated with kids so much that they even bought into the pizza Lunchables, which is a Lunchables with a cold pizza dough, cold cheese, and cold pizza sauce that the child can put together for him or herself in the lunchroom. And that was a huge thing for kids, and sales skyrocketed. And from there, they went on to hamburger Lunchables and hot dog Lunchables and pancake Lunchables, all cold, and the kids just loved it.
You know, it is funny that it's not about the taste of the food, even in that case.
Not for the kids. And one thing that somebody explained to me is that kids tend to, decide whether they like something or not first with their eyes and then the taste. Mm. Adults tend to be a little bit more forgiving of appearance. The general truism, although I certainly like the appearance of foods or not, as the case may be. But yeah, there's so many other things besides salt, sugar, fat that come into play that the food scientists of these companies know fully well. Texture. One of my favorite expressions that they have is vanishing caloric density. And
yeah.
That's when something like a Cheetos dissolves in your mouth before your mouth will send a signal to the brain saying, hey, I'm eating something really chunky here that's probably going to deliver a load of calories.
Mm-hmm.
When it dissolves, the brain is fooled into thinking the calories have vanished, thus the term.
Talk about this, Michael. What has happened to snacking in this country? It seems to me there was a time when snacking was something we associated, you know, occasionally with children, but it wasn't like adults needed multiple snacks every day.
Yeah, you know, and I certainly was raised by my parents to avoid snacking in between meals, to avoid spoiling my appetite. And somewhere in the 80s, and people do ascribe some part of the obesity crisis to this, somewhere in the early 80s, it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. So you started seeing people eating, walking down the street. You started people seeing bringing snacks to business meetings that didn't used to be. And that had a remarkable effect on our diet habits. People also at the same time stopped eating regular three meals a day. And when they did that, their dependence on snack foods increased. And so you can see, you know, the prevalence of the snack machine at the office or the snack counter at the grocery store became a much larger part of our lives.
Let's go on the line now to Sarah in Plano. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just want to say this show is fascinating. I want to know the people that cooperated with you, those scientists, were they ex-employees, and what are they doing now?
You know, most of them are ex-employees because they invented these products back in the early 80s in sort of a more innocent era. I have to say I'm in touch with all of them now, and they are chomping at the bit to go back to work and help these same companies now finally come up with truly more healthful products, because they're convinced that with, you know, more energy put on true research, and they complain that there isn't a lot of new inventing really going on in companies, at food companies these days, but by really sort of applying their expertise, they could help these same companies turn things around, win back the public trust, and really take a whack at the obesity crisis. And it's so heartening to talk to them these days.
So use that same research about how to make food taste good and try to formulate things that don't have so much sugar, salt, and fat.
Yeah, I think they're really convinced, especially people like Howard Moskowitz, who I've been talking to. He is just a genius at the kind of mathematics and intense research that needs to go into designing, as he says, engineering foods, and he's convinced he can do it with healthful ingredients and not salt, sugar, fat.
Let's speak to Kara in Fort Worth. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the show. Especially as a parent of small children trying to make decisions about what kinds of things to give them or not.
Wow.
Appreciate the topic. Yeah. So I'd love to hear Mr. Moss talk about corn syrup and how it ended up and everything and why we accept it as an appropriate substitute for sugar.
You know, high fructose corn syrup had one huge benefit when it was invented and came along. It was liquid, and it was less expensive than table sugar, and that's why you saw the soda companies start using high fructose corn syrup instead of table sugar. But I have to say, having talked to what I think are the smartest nutrition scientists out there, they generally agree that when it comes to calories and obesity, sugar is sugar is sugar. Table sugar is corn syrup, is high fructose corn syrup, and I should also add is fruit concentrate, which you're starting to see more of in the grocery store.
Which is a tricky way of hiding sugar in a food, isn't it?
Yes, and in fact, fruit concentrate can have actually more fructose, which if anything is more problematic than table sugar, it's pure fructose, some recent science is suggesting. But over the years, you know, the sugar companies, whether it's cane sugar or beet or corn-based, you know, have played this sort of game where one of them is the villain one decade and the other is the villain the next, and sometimes the food companies will swap one out for another for marketing supremacy. But ultimately, again, I'm in the camp of listening to these nutritionists say that when it comes to calories, they're all about on equal footing. You need to be careful of them all and not overindulge.
We have Rick on the line in Joshua. Hey, Rick.
Hey, I want to make this real quick. I listened to your whole show. It's very informative. I didn't hear anything about peanut butter. I was raised as a PBJ kid, and the taste of peanut butter has changed, and we see more peanut butter snacks. When I was a kid, you just bought the little peanut butter crackers, and that was about all there is, and now it's peanut butter everything. So I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Mm.
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Michael?
Well, my kids love peanut butter. I mean, I try to avoid the peanut butter with sugar added, and sometimes that does cost more than regular peanut butter, which is one of the real grievances, you know, food health advocates have at the grocery store. I have to say, I will never endorse a fad diet or any one solution to the obesity crisis, but the very smartest scientists, including Walter Willett at Harvard, have convinced me that nuts may, in fact, be magical. There's something about a handful of unsalted nuts that have a nice blend of fats that aren't too heavy in saturated fat that will fill you up for hours. And I found in researching and writing this book, and I experimented, I would grab a handful of cashews, and sure enough, that would last me until dinner time. You have to be careful not to overindulge because they're loaded with calories. But I think peanut butter, even though peanuts are legumes, I think they fall into that same sort of category that it really is a pretty healthful food if you don't overindulge and you don't combine it with a lot of other things that might, you know, increase the calorie and the fat load.
Can you talk a little bit, Michael, about buzzwords that are used on food labeling that may sort of lead us to think foods are healthier or more natural than they might actually be?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us know walking into the grocery store that you really need to pay attention to the fine print nutrition facts label. But I like to say that it's important to start right up front with the outside fronts of the packages, especially when they're touting things like low fat, low sugar, added calcium, added vitamins. I mean, often that, you know, ends up being a diversion, a distraction. And those low-fat products can be loaded with sugar. And the low-sugar products can be loaded with fat and salt. And the low-salt products can have tons of both. And sometimes companies, in order to keep their products most attractive and alluring, will even increase the amount of the other ingredients when they decrease the one that they're touting on the front of the package.
Back to the phones now. This time, let's speak with Eva in North Fort Worth. Hi, Eva.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I am just really enjoying this show. My husband and I try to watch all the food documentaries we can get our hands on. But anyway, I just have a few comments. Like, all my friends seem to, not all of them, but quite a few, they're suckers when it comes to, like, the cheese sticks. And I'm always feeling like, wow, that's, like, a lot of extra fat there for your kid. You know, that always comes with a nice little smiley face on it. And
Like the mozzarella sticks? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the mozzarella sticks. And also the cereal, like, or wherever you go down the aisles, there's just princesses and, like, little cartoons that really the kids really want to get to those cereals and pick out, you know, the little one that has the princess. And usually those are the ones that have the highest sugar. So I just feel like, you know, sometimes you're in a trap.
It's a real struggle shopping with kids. I mean, my boys are 8 and 13. My wife arbitrarily set a limit of 5 grams of sugar per cereal. And we found that it sort of engages the kids. And they go on almost what is like an Easter egg hunt in the cereal aisle. And they may have to reach low or they may have to reach high. But there are better lower sugar cereals that they actually find attractive if they've searched them out themselves, like Cheerios, which can have as little as 1 gram sugar per serving. The cheese thing is really interesting. Again, I fall back on the advice of nutritionists like Walter Willett. He says, look, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of tasty cheese in your diet if you're eating it for itself. It's when cheese is used as a hidden additive in processed food that it's become a problem.
When you refer to they may have to reach low or reach high, that's in fact the reality is that healthier foods tend to not be at eye level. Is that right?
Yeah, healthier foods, they tend to be low and high because they're not selling as well. When companies tout their kind of, you know, their healthier version, which are really extension lines of the mainline products, those just don't sell as well. And so they're positioned on the shelf, you know, away from eye level. They've done studies of shoppers where they put gizmos on your head that measure and monitor your eye movements. And they know that when you hit the aisle, your eye goes to the center part of the aisle at eye level. So that's where they put the most profitable, most highly loaded products right there.
So all of this speaks, Michael, to the fact that we as consumers do have a certain amount of power here if we sort of operate en masse and demand healthier choices?
Absolutely. And companies make a really convincing argument. They never intended to make America obese, never intended to make us sick, that they do consider nutrition as an important part of their menu. But again, everything they do when you walk in the grocery store adds up to a huge incentive to buy some of the worst products in the store. And I'm hoping that this book, by revealing these schemes and strategies of the companies, empowers people to level the playing field so you're better equipped to resist their marketing and find those foods that work for you and your family.
Do you think there will be a sort of tobacco-style outrage among Americans?
I think we're starting to see more and more people really concerned about what they're putting into their bodies and starting to clamor for the industry to do something. At the same time, the industry is under huge pressure from shareholders. These are companies that are in the business of making money, after all. They're not evil empires, and they're under pressure from Wall Street to keep profits up, quite frankly. They're between a rock and a hard place, and they have become so dependent on salt, sugar, fat. So I think all three of those things are coming together and clashing right now.
Michael Moss reports for The New York Times. His new book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast at kera.org/think. It's free. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.